cause the structure. First of all, and this is something uncontroversial in statistics, people would agree that if we are allowed to do interventions, if we can design experiments and ask experimental questions, then we can do that, and that's what we do as scientists all the time when we design experiments. Now, maybe the more interesting question is, can we do it without interventions? Can we do it based on observations alone? And there, this is a work that, an area that a number of people have pioneered over the last 20 years. Turns out there are certain assumptions, one is called faithfulness, which allow us to do it by running conditional independence testing. So I told you before that a certain graph structure implies a set of conditional independence properties. It turns out that one can go backwards. One can test for conditional independence properties and from that infer something about the graph. But it turns out we cannot find the graph, but in the typical case, just an equivalence class of graphs. So even if we know the distribution completely, we can do all conditional independence tests, which is a very difficult problem in statistics. We typically still don't get a single graph. We get a class of explanations. And it turns out even for the very simplest graphs, graphs that have just two nodes, two observables, it doesn't work. So in that case, it turns out we always end up with a class of we cannot distinguish whether A causes B or B causes A, essentially. So it doesn't solve the simplest case, and that's where we enter this field, and we looked at this problem exactly. So the question is, what kind of assumptions can help us in the case where we have only two observables? So when can we decide what is cause and what is effect? And to do this, let's take a look at these functional models again for the particular case where we have only two variables. So let's consider this very simple graph, X causes Y. Now, I mentioned before that we have these noise or unexplained variables. So there's one here, there's one here, so one at each node. First of all, I should say that since this is the parent here, the X, so it's not influenced by anything else, so X is just a function of its own noise variable, we can actually identify X with the noise. It's just a deterministic function of some noise. So let's ignore this node down here, so we're left with these three. And remember before I was telling you that the noises have to be jointly independent, which now in this simple case translates into saying that this variable has to be independent of this one. Now if we consider a general functional model of this form, then it's actually a rather a general kind of beast, because it looks like this, and here's our noise variable, and let's think of a very simple case where the noise variable only takes discrete values, so it's not even a continuous variable, a discrete noise variable taking different values. Then of course such a model could encode a scenario where the noise randomly switches between D different mechanisms. So we think of F as a physical mechanism, and the noise's role is simply to switch between D different mechanisms. So this is perfectly fine for the model, but of course, intuitively, it would seem that it should be very hard to identify such a situation, because D can be large or it can be even continuous. So how can we solve such a problem possibly? So we thought we have to somehow restrict the complexity with which the noise acts on this function class, on the function class of mechanisms taking X to Y. And one way to do this is to assume additive noise. So assuming additive noise, you can think of in various ways. You can say it's something like a local linearization of the noise effect. It's assuming like the noise is small or the function is relatively smooth in the range of the noise. But of course, it's a strong restriction, and it turns out this will make the problem solvable. And to give you an intuition why it makes the problem solvable, let's look at this simple picture here. So we have X and Y. We want to decide, is X causing Y or is Y causing X? Now, we make the assumption that we have additive noise, and let's make things even simpler. Let's think of the noise as something that has bounded range. So now, if X causes Y, it means there is some there's some deterministic function f and some additive noise with bounded range, such that the picture looks like this. So bounded range, of course the noise is additive, it means this range is the same everywhere. So this slab around that function has the same height everywhere. And of course that means if we now look backward, if we think about the problem whether we can interpret y as an input on x or y as the cause and x as an effect with additive noise again, then it's not going to work, because even though the range of the noise will still be bounded, this range will vary as we change y, which is now the hypothetical cause or the input. And why does it vary? It varies because the function is nonlinear. So it turns out for linear functions that's not true, and for linear, in particular for linear functions in Gaussian noise, we can always fit the model in both directions. But it turns out for nonlinear functions, in the generic case, this problem becomes, or this model becomes identifiable in the sense that based on data alone, we can decide whether x is causing y or y is causing x. And one can formulate this mathematically in terms of this kind of result, which I will not go into detail on, but simply, briefly, it just specifies if we have an additive noise model in the forward direction, and if we assume that in addition we can fit an additive noise model in the backward direction, then from these two conditions we can derive a certain differential equation for which we can prove that it has a small solution space, a three-dimensional solution space. And it turns out that some known cases lie in this solution space, such as linear functions and Gaussian noise. Now, how can we use this in practice? Well, the easiest approach would be simply to say, well, we have two variables. We perform nonlinear regression and look at the residual errors, which are our hypothetical additive noises. And then we check whether these residual errors are statistically independent of the input. And we can do this in both directions. Of course, we have to use some good statistical independence tests or dependence measures, not just correlation, but we also have to check for higher order. And if we do this, for instance, in this case, this is a data set that contains the altitude and the temperature of different places in Germany. Then in the forward direction, it turns out, so the forward direction we would assume is that the altitude causes the temperature. It's certainly physically conceivable that the altitude has an effect on the temperature. It is less likely that the temperature has an effect on the altitude of a place, even though one could hypothetically construct cases where maybe this measurement process is taken in cities and people preferentially found their cities in nice sunny meadows in the mountains, or I don't know. But certainly it's more plausible to have this as the correct direction. And lo and behold, it turns out that our model finds independent noises in this direction and highly dependent noises in the opposite direction. One can make this a little bit more sophisticated by observing that just performing standard regression may not be the most clever thing to do, because in the end, depending what you do for regression, for instance, if you just did linear regression, then maybe you would get errors that are dependent on the input just because the model doesn't fit the data. On the other hand, if you take a highly nonlinear regression method, you don't regularize, maybe the noises will be zero, which will be independent of the input. So there's something going on here. So we developed a regression method that, rather than minimizing error, minimizes the residual dependence, or the dependence of the residual errors on the input, which I think is maybe an interesting approach anyway, because it means in regression, or in this kind of regression, our goal is to use up all information in the inputs, in the sense that the residual errors should be statistically independent of the inputs, so there should be no information left in the errors. And we do this by minimizing a dependence measure, which is, now that's the short excursion to kernels, minimizing a dependence measure which corresponds to a certain quantity in a reproducing kernel Hilbert space. Maybe I will just very briefly explain the idea, because maybe independence testing is an interesting topic for neuroscientists also. So this method is called the Hilbert-Schmidt independence criterion, and it's based on the idea that one can represent probability measures in a reproducing kernel Hilbert space, in a feature space, like a support vector machine feature space, by taking the mapping into the kernel space. So that's one way to write this mapping, and then taking the expectation with respect to the distribution that you want to represent in that space. So given a distribution in the input space, you map it to the expectation of the kernel mapping under this distribution. So that's to some vector or some function in the Hilbert space. And it turns out for certain kernels, this is an injective mapping. We don't lose information. So we can represent our measures this way, and that's nice. We now have them in a Hilbert space. We can do all sorts of things, such as develop a nice dependence measures if we consider the particular case where the two, where we map two distributions into a Hilbert space, and one of them is our joint distribution, and the other one is the product of the two marginals. So if we compare a joint distribution to the product of its two marginals, then this gives us a nice quantity and a nice test statistics that will describe the dependence between these two variables. So that's just a brief digression. That's the kind of methods that we use, and one can generalize this also to conditional independence testing, which is a significantly harder problem. But now I want to show you, so that's one way to introduce an asymmetry between cause and effect, to assume additive noise. It's a strong assumption, but it makes the problem solvable. But it's interesting to think about other types of assumptions or other types of footprints of causal structure in the two-variable case. And I'm going to tell you about another type of assumption that I find quite interesting and that we're using in a number of domains now, and that's the following. So this, just to remind you briefly again of our simple causal structure, we have two variables, one is cause, one is effect. We have a function that computes the effect by taking as input the cause and a noise variable. It's a deterministic function. We now make the assumption that the probability distribution over the cause, which is basically probability distribution of the noise without restricting generality, and the probability distribution of the effect given the cause, so this is something that you can think of as the mechanism. So these two objects we now assume to be independent. And I put this in inverted commas because it's not quite clear what one should mean by independence here. So from the intuitive or physical point of view, it just means there's a mechanism here out there in the world, and this mechanism doesn't care what you feed into it. So no matter what input distribution you put in, the mechanism doesn't change. And maybe it's a reasonable assumption if there are no complicated feedback loops that have somehow tuned this mechanism to particular types of inputs. But again, it's an assumption that may not always be true. Now, if we make this assumption, it turns out we can solve the problem even if we don't have additive noise, even if we don't have noise at all, which is somewhat surprising because the previous method looks like it's heavily relying on the noise. And to give you the idea why this works, let's look at this simple case here. So we have two variables. There's a deterministic relationship between the two, and we assume it's an invertible function. Makes things simpler, and also, in a sense, if the function were not invertible, it would be asymmetric to begin with. So that's also, in a sense, looks too easy. So let's make it invertible. And we don't have additive noise, but of course the inputs have some distribution, and the outputs, as a consequence, will have some distribution. So we put in some distribution over the causes. We don't know it. We have some nonlinear function, and we will get some distribution over the outputs. Now, if you think about how do you compute this distribution over the outputs, it will depend on this distribution, and it will depend on the function. And in particular, wherever the function was very flat, the output distribution will have large mass just by how the distributions or the densities transform. So this means that in some sense, if this this output distribution contains some traces of this mechanism. The question is, can we detect these traces? Now, in the general case, if we don't make assumptions about this input distribution and how it relates to the function, then of course the input distribution could be such that it exactly matches the nonlinearities of the function and that we cannot detect the traces in the output. But of course, we are making this assumption now that I showed you in the last slide, so we are assuming that the input distribution is independent of the mechanism. And we're going to formalize it in a particular way in this problem. And the particular way, I don't know whether I should go into all details on this, but maybe just briefly for the ones that are interested in, it's possible to do this by viewing both the density and the logarithm of the derivative of the function as random variables on a certain probability space, and then postulating that a certain type of covariance vanishes. It turns out, So this is now our postulate of independence between mechanism and input. So the mechanism is F, the input is P, or P sub X. So there we are assuming this is our formalization of independence. And it turns out if we make this assumption, then we can prove that for nonlinear functions, this quantity will be strictly positive in the backward direction. So it will be zero by assumption in the forward direction and strictly positive in the backward direction. And we can, in principle, try to estimate this from data. And we have done that. And this gives us a hint as to whether forward direction is x causing y or y causing x. Okay, so one can show that this kind of assumption can be rewritten in various ways. Again, I think I will not go into all details on this. One can write it as a certain type of additivity of entropy. One can also write it in this way, which is sort of my favorite expression, which basically says, so if the output distribution looks irregular, and irregularity here is measured by the relative entropy or Kullback-Leibler divergence between the observed output distribution and a uniform output distribution. So the size of this thing is a measure of the irregularity of the output, and of course the output will look irregular if the function is very irregular or if the input is very irregular. And in a certain sense, this expression says that it will actually be exactly the sum of these two things under our independence assumption. Okay, so I hope you didn't find this completely strange, but now I want to show you some empirical results to convince you that maybe there's something about these assumptions that makes them suitable for real-world data, and we have collected a number of input-output or cause-effect data sets, such as the one that I mentioned before, this altitude temperature data set, or this is a data set for some snails. This is from the UC Irvine benchmark collection about the various features of age or length of I cannot read it very well on my screen. So certain aspects where we think we have a reasonable guess as to what's the correct causal direction. So if we do this, we get the following results. So this is a complicated graph, but maybe just in a nutshell. So the gray area is the area where our results are not significant, in the sense that if we were to decide on the causal direction, xy or yx, just by random guessing, then in 95% of the cases we would end up in this gray area. So let's look for whether we can be outside of that area, and it turns out that this information geometric method that I just showed you, that's the blue method, can work quite well. And here, this x-axis, the decision rate, simply specifies how often we force the algorithm to decide. So typically, these algorithms, they have some statistics that they compare in the forward and backward direction. And of course, if these values are very similar, you might want to say, they're too similar, I don't want to decide. So this is the x-axis. We force them to decide always, we're over here, and we can do better than chance, both for the blue curve, which is this information geometric method, and, well, for the additive noise model, this is the red one, we're actually close to the gray area, but as we allow some rejections of decisions, we can get rather accurate. So when we first got these kinds of results, we were surprised that this problem, in principle, it seems it can be solved on empirical data, even though in the past people thought that this two-variable problem cannot be solved. So that's an application for the two-variable case. And since this is a neuroscience audience, I just wanted to briefly mention there's also, we have some people in the lab who have tried to apply some of these causal inference methods also to neuroscience data, but I'm not going to talk about this today, but if you want, send me an email afterwards, and I can send you some papers. But I should say it's a difficult problem to apply these methods to real data and get results that you can defend without hand waving. So now, finally, I want to tell you something about an interesting link between causal inference or causal learning and statistical learning. Maybe also a kind of a motivation why we are interested in this problem of distinguishing cause and effect. It turns out when we do machine learning, we sometimes learn in the causal direction, and sometimes we learn in the anti-causal or backwards direction. And I'll show you two examples. One is a problem from computational biology, where you want to predict the splice form, or maybe eventually the gene, or maybe even the protein encoded by a gene, based on a sequence of messenger RNA. We know that there is a biological mechanism, or maybe a whole set of biological mechanisms, starting with a ribosome that takes as the input the mRNA and then produces genes and precursors to proteins, etc. So this is the forward direction. This is the mechanism in the real world is aligned with this direction. So if we were to predict, for instance, the gene from this data, then our direction of prediction would be in the same direction as the mechanism. On the other hand, if we are looking at something like optical character recognition, then we are actually doing the prediction in the backward direction, because if you imagine how such an image is produced, it's produced by someone deciding to write the digit 3 in their head and then producing an image of a digit 3. So the class membership of the digit in that sense is the cause of the image, and if we want to classify digits, we are actually learning backwards. So what kind of consequences does this have? Now let's again make this assumption about the independence. So the independence of the probability distribution or the density over the cause and the mechanism. And it turns out this assumption then introduces certain asymmetries that have implications for various learning tasks. Now, I know this is not a machine learning audience. I don't know who has heard the term semi-supervised learning? So that's still quite a few. Who has heard about the problem of covariate shift correction? That's a little bit less. And transfer learning. So I think these are all interesting topics of modern machine learning, and there are interesting implications. So it turns out, for instance, if you want to do semi-supervised learning means rather than just having observations of pairs of X and Y and learning the mapping from X to Y, we have additional observations of only X, so only inputs. And then people come up with all sorts of algorithms to improve the estimation of the mapping from X to Y. Now, it turns out if we do this in the forward direction, it doesn't make any sense, because by our assumption, P of the cause doesn't contain any information about the conditional. So even if we have a lot more data on the input, it doesn't tell us any more about the function that we're trying to estimate, because the function is just the conditional expectation of output given input. So that shouldn't make sense, and vice versa. In the backward direction, it should make sense. And the situation is the opposite for covariate shift correction. So covariate shift correction is about the problem where we have data, X and Y, but afterwards, and we learn some function, afterwards we want to apply it to a case where suddenly X is from a different distribution. So it turns out for that case, it's the opposite. And I'll just briefly mention semi-supervised learning a little bit in more detail. So people have come up with a number of assumptions to justify why semi-supervised learning should work at all. And we've looked at these assumptions, and it turns out all of these assumptions actually are assumptions about connections between the P of X and P of Y given X. So they're all is assumptions about this kind of statement of independence. So remember, I told you that if we make the independence assumption in the forward direction, it implies dependence in the backward direction. And then in the backward direction is the case where semi-supervised learning should, in principle, help. So in the backward direction, we can exploit these assumptions, and they all fit into the picture. And I'll make it short. We didn't do experiments, but we reused a number of experiments other people have run. We looked at a number of benchmark studies in semi-supervised learning. The only thing we did is that we labeled the data sets that people were using. So we labeled them as, of course, before we did the analysis, as causal or anti-causal or confounded, and then interpret the results. And it turns out this is very much consistent. So for instance, this case here, it's a particular type of semi-supervised learning called self-training. In this case, one can see that in all the causal cases, so this is the baseline, the supervised learning case, and this is the changes of performance that you get if you apply this kind of semi-supervised learning In all the causal cases, it doesn't get better. That's what we were predicting. In some of the anti-causal cases, it does get better. So we're not claiming it always has to get better, but at least in principle, it can get better. And the same applies for cases that are confounded. I haven't discussed this one, but in principle, it should also be possible there. We can get similar kinds of results also in regression, but I'll skip that. So I think, turns out, just to show a few pictures at the end, I think I actually haven't spoken that long yet, but it was partly your introduction, but I'll stop, don't worry. I think a very nice example of this ideas of that you are more robust with respect to distribution changes if you take into account what's the causal direction is actually the problem of deconvolution, which we have looked a lot in image processing. So in the case of deconvolution, you can interpret things like this. You have a cause, that's the true image you want to reconstruct. You have a mechanism, for instance, camera shake, that introduces the transformation of your true image, and now you observe the effect, and then you want to reconstruct this cause given the effect. And if you do it in the correct direction, you can do it such that it generalizes very well across the image, so to different types of statistics, and we can then correct this kind of motion blur rather well. And we've done something similar for lens error correction. So this is with a self-built lens, which produces rather poor images, like this one, which is really quite blurry in the corners. And if we do the correction, we can get this kind of images. Initially, in a non-blind setting where we measure the point spread functions, but by now also in a blind setting where we're just given the blurry image and reconstruct this relatively sharp image from that. So I think I should come to an end now and acknowledge my co-workers. Thank you very much.
Take some questions. So we can take the questions. Thank you.
Oh, this one. Okay.
Please.
Then give it to Sue. Mm-hmm. Oh, nicht mehr.
Thank you. Bernard. I have a short question. What happened to time in your theory?
Yeah, that's interesting. Hello? Does it work? Can you hear me? So the question is, what about time? So that's the important question, and I sort of enjoy talking about causality without mentioning the word time, which is a bit weird, I agree. So, but I think actually time doesn't solve the problem. So if you note time, so if your variables, for instance, you could have a graphical model that's actually a time series. So if your variables come with a timestamp, it excludes certain causal directions if we are willing to make the assumption that the past cannot influence the future. Of course, it doesn't tell us what are the true causal directions, but because not everything that's in the past is a cause for the future, so it just reduces the search space a little bit. So from that point of view, in principle, it makes it a little bit harder, but it doesn't solve the actual problem. So we still have to solve the problem that we are now trying to solve in the case where we don't have time information. So in a certain sense, we are now trying to solve the general case, the harder case, but I'm not sure it's that much harder because it's not clear what is the biggest issue in causality. It might well be that the biggest issue is actually, for instance, the detection of confounders. So in the case of time series, so I'm not sure which direction to talk because I didn't see okay. So in the case of time series, there are these methods such as Granger causality, and they work if you are willing to make the assumption of causal completeness. So if you're willing to assume there are no confounders that are unobserved, then you can do things. But the hard problem in real life is, of course, this question of confounders, because if you can have confounders, then something like Granger causality can go arbitrarily wrong. So from that point of view, even if you have time, the problem is still almost as hard as without time.
So can you extend your method in the two variable case? Can you extend your method to include the possibility of hidden causes, which also seems to be quite relevant for the semi-supervised case?
Yes, yeah. So we have we have an extension for the case where we have up to three variables. So in a sense, the case that Reichenbach talks about, an extension where we still make this assumption of additive noise. This extension basically works as follows. It takes the two variables that you observe and then performs a dimensionality reduction, where the dimensionality reduction has the goal of making the residual errors, like the representation errors, statistically independent of the latent variable that you're reconstructing. And if you, we have some theoretical results, but they make some relatively strong assumptions where you can prove that in certain cases this is identifiable. So in principle, if you're willing to make assumptions, one can maybe solve such problems, yeah.